This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Raising children, writes Ann Crittenden, may be the most important job in the world, but you can't put it on a resume. Our stated values, she says, are not reflected in the policies of American business, government, and the law. Ann Crittenden is our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She joins us to talk about the costs women take on when they become mothers. Crittenden is the author of The Price of Motherhood, Why the Most Important Job in the World is Still the Least Valued. Listeners, your questions and comments are encouraged. I look forward to your calls. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Ann Crittenden is a former reporter for The New York Times, a Pulitzer Prize nominee. She has also worked for Fortune, Newsweek, and CBS News. She's written articles for many publications, including The Nation, Foreign Affairs, and McCall's. Her new book, The Price of Motherhood, is published by Metropolitan Books, a division of Henry Holt. She joins us from Washington, D.C., where she lives with her husband and son. 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Ann Crittenden, good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
After you became a mother, it was then that you realized the responsibility of raising children didn't accord much respect. What was your experience?
Well, it was one of shock, because I was an older mother. I was over 40 when my one and only beloved child was born, and I thought, oh, man, this is so important. You know, I was sin of pride. Never was it so struck down, you know. I was very excited, and I had been an established journalist, and I thought, okay, you know, I'm a serious person. Everybody treats me with respect, and now I'm a mother, and that's, in my view, it was the most challenging thing I'd ever been privileged to do. You know, I thought it called on all more skills than anything I'd ever done before. So I would go out to the Washington cocktail party and say, to what do you do? I'd say, well, I'm a new mother. And boom, the eyes would go over the shoulder, the person would wither away and vanish. You know, it was amazing. But my biggest story on that score was somebody came running up to me at a cocktail party a few years after my son was born and said, hey, didn't you used to be Ann Crittenden?
Mm.
So I said, well, there's the metaphor for the invisibility of the people who raise kids. It's just not on their screen. It's not on the screen of quote-unquote important jobs.
But
yeah, we all know it really is.
Yeah, but you own up in the book to having been guilty of that attitude yourself.
Right. When you don't have kids, it's hard to imagine. I do think one of the great dividing lines in life is before and after you have a child. And it's really hard to appreciate what a challenging job it is. And if you, particularly if you haven't gotten into the literature, you haven't read any child development, you're not aware of how important those early years are. Or in my case, one reason this book came about is that I happen to be an economic journalist. So I was also, you know, familiar with the fact that we're now increasingly seeing children or human capabilities, which are formed in childhood, as the most important national resources that a country can have. So if that's true, and now there is general agreement that's true, then people raising children really do have the most important job in the economy. So I was pretty aware of that, and yet, so, you know, when I had a kid, I was ready to change my attitude, I'll put it that way.
Why do we discount the work of mothering?
Well, I've asked myself that for many years. I think, you know, one of the most fundamental underlying reasons is that women do it, and women's work historically has been devalued, even to the extent, as you can see, and as an industry becomes more and more female, more women take the job, it starts losing status and losing pay, like bank tellers, for instance. Or certain jobs used to be men, and when women began to take them over, somehow we started thinking of them as less challenging and less remunerative. So I think that's one of the basic reasons. But I also think, and this may be related, is that we don't value it because the people who pretty much run things have never done it. Very few people in positions of power have ever had hands-on experience raising children. So they really are ignorant of what's going on here and how important this work is.
Hmm. There's a chapter in the book that is titled How Mother's Work Was Disappeared, The Invention of the Unproductive Housewife. And at the outset of that chapter, you ask a couple of questions that I'll pose to you, back to you, and let you talk about them. How did the demanding job of rearing a child come to be trivialized as babysitting? When did caring for children become a labor of love, smothered under a blanket of sentimentality that hides its economic importance?
Okay, I love that research. I had so much fun discovering this story, really, of how essentially before we had a money economy, before industrialization, the man and wife worked together in the homestead, and each one was considered a very productive member of the family. Wives were subordinate to husbands, but they were considered productive workers, helpmeets, you know. And it was only when the money economy came in and most men began to leave the home and earn wages or start businesses or whatever and begin to bring in money income that productive labor began to be associated with money. And if you weren't earning money, somehow you must not be very productive. And that concept, that idea, just sort of gradually took hold in the 19th century. And you can see in the census, every 10 years, more and more and more, it became, first of all, they would count the whole productive output of the whole family together. And then they broke it down into individuals somewhere along the mid-century. And by the turn of the 20th century, women working at home, raising kids, and all the other things they were doing was classified as unproductive. They were classified as dependents, and that's how it happened. And suddenly you had you had the idea that this was simply sentimental, emotional activity or unskilled activity that really didn't make a major economic contribution, which I called a giant theft. It was shocking, really.
So does that explain that when the GNP index was developed, gross national product, that domestic activity was left out of the equation?
Right, that's exactly right. That parallels with the census, the beginnings of counting the GNP, counting the gross national product. But that was in the early 20th century, that whole thing came in, that calculating GNP, it was called. And they just left it out. There was no thought of putting in work that isn't money associated. So money became everything. And anything that wasn't bought and sold was not considered part of the GDP, was not considered productive. Hmm. And still to this day, as we know. Hmm. So that's one of the things I do feel we should change.
Should mothers be paid?
Well, I would put it this way. I would say mothers should not bear so much, if not almost all, the costs of raising children. It's not only that they're not paid, they pay themselves almost all the costs of raising kids. If you'd like, I can mention that now, that the biggest cost of a child nowadays isn't really the expenditure, which is huge, huge, as you know. I mean, it costs a great deal of money to raise a kid. But the biggest cost is also invisible. It's the cost of the one parent being the family caregiver, of one parent making a family and making a home for a child. And in order to do that in this economy, you can't, it's almost impossible to hold down one of these 24/7 jobs. So women make a lot of decisions around the edges, either to work part-time or not to work for money at all, or to work at less demanding jobs. And those decisions added together radically reduce their lifetime income, and that's the single biggest cost of raising children, and women bear it. I call it the mommy tax.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In the book, there are many examples. Yourself, you figure out what the cost, the mommy tax cost you and your family. Also, there's another story in the book you tell of another journalist, Cindy DiBiase,
yeah.
Who tried with all her might to be a mommy and be a good reporter, and with a lot of hard work, she did it. But then when her second child came along, it just all came crashing down.
Yeah, it's a straw that breaks the camel's back often for women, I think. The second baby. Sometimes you can get a work out a system that'll work with one, but then when you have two, it all falls apart. I had many cases of women I interviewed that had happened to. In her case, it was, I can't remember the exact chronology, but with the second baby, she really then said, basically, it was a story of I need to work a shorter work week, and they wouldn't.
She was being asked to stay.
Instead of giving her more 9-to-5 type hours, they gave her longer hours. They took her off her beat, which was medical care, into general assignment, which meant she had to work late every night, knowing that she would quit. That's how they kind of squeezed her out.
Yeah, she was asked to stay and work till 9:30, 10 o'clock at night, and when she said, well, the person who's providing child care in my family cannot stay that long. Mm-hmm. And they said, well, why not? Tough.
You know what really was fascinating in that case? One of the editors, she claimed, said to her, well, don't you have a husband? Thinking, well, why didn't the other spouse do this, you know? And I was also interviewing on another story where the man wanted to come home a little earlier, and somebody said, well, doesn't he have a wife? So the point is, in every serious, conscientious family, somebody's got to be the husband or the wife who takes care of the kids, who's looking out for them, or both of them need to do it different times. You know, no family can ignore this and raise a child. But we just don't have a system that makes it possible.
And that squeeze that people are feeling has got to also be affecting marriages.
Exactly. There's tremendous stress in marriage because, well, you know, I don't need to go into why there's tremendous stress. Women's magazines are full of that one, I think.
This is the Afternoon Magazine, and we're talking this afternoon with Anne Crittenden about her book, The Price of Motherhood, Why the Most Important Job in the World is Still the Least Valued. We have a listener waiting to talk with us on line one in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
You were discussing how mothers were no longer considered productive because there was no money involved in what they do. I found it interesting, though, there is a segment of the economy that does seem to put a dollar value on it, and that's life insurance companies. My husband and I was searching around shopping for life insurance policies for the both of us, and my policy, they always wanted to write a higher value, that I was worth more than my husband, because if I were to die, the equivalent of services he would have to get in nanny or whatever to replace what I was doing was worth more.
Interesting.
I thought that was quite enlightening.
Does that mean that you would have to pay higher premiums then because you were worth more to get that policy?
Of course, actually.
Yeah, well, so they had an economic motive.
Yeah, but it was still...
But it's very valid, I think.
Yeah, but of course only... In a death would, I work anyways, but you know, as a mother, you know, they assume that my contribution to raising family in the household, unvalued part of the money I wasn't contributing,
exactly.
Was actually worth more after I was dead.
Oh God!
So
that's fascinating.
But I thought it was interesting.
Yeah.
I like the show. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Other calls are welcome. Questions, comments, join us with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. In the book, Anne, you talk about, I found this very interesting, the patterns of childbearing in the 20th century for educated women. Women with an education in 1910, the clear choice was career or family. 1933, job, then family. The 50s, family, then job. Baby boomers, career, then family. Although I think with baby boomers, we have a pattern of career, then family, then career.
That's where we're seeing people trying to re-enter the workforce and pick up where they left off. Yeah. Also, with the baby boomers, one of the things that really surprised me in that research was the number of baby boomers who didn't have children at all was so high. It's now the story sort of in, you know. And this one particular study found that 28% of college-educated baby boomer women did not have children at all. So the childlessness is very, very high in that group. And I think it really is another part of the price of motherhood, because it was so hard to combine that family life with whatever you've been trained to do professionally, that a lot of women just waited too late or just never did have children at all. So I think, and in countries where it is easier to put the two together, more women have children than in this country.
I quoted you in those figures, those years and the choices. And you use the words career and job, and you use them in different ways, I think. Is there a difference? What I'm getting at here is, are there class differences in women's experiences with motherhood in the workplace?
Oh, sure. I mean, the study you're talking about is college educated. That's Claudia Golden's work from Harvard. And that's who she was looking at when we talk career, job, and then career, family, and maybe back to career. Although I've met a lot of people who do career, family, and don't go back. Because in my case, for instance, you know, I was over 40 when I had my child. And then I put family, you know, basically family with freelance writing. And by the time you raise your child, you're so old, you're never going to go back to the same kind of career. So that's another, I'm a little not so sure it's career, family, career, if particularly as children are coming later and later in life. Unless things change, we run up against an age situation as well when women try to get back into the labor force after raising some kids. Or depending on how, one thing about American women is we're all individuals and their patterns are all over the place.
Very different.
But back to the class thing. Sure, I mean, if you're blue collar, pink collar, you know, it's a job. And I don't know exactly what your point would be, but, though, you know, American women are working, no matter what their class, they are working for pay outside the home now, by and large. More women with, let's say, high school educations stay at home than more highly educated women. But by the same token, the United States has one of the highest rates in the world, of the developed world, of college-educated women who stay at home with children. So it's kind of, this stuff is very interesting and not easily generalized, you know.
Is there a rift, do you think, between moms with kids who stay at home and moms who work?
That's been given a lot of play in the press over the last 10 years. And I frankly set out to say, well, I'm not going to exaggerate this stuff. I don't really, you know, like the media exploiting, you know, women's differences and that sort of thing. But I must say I did find that it does exist, although I think it is diminishing because, for one thing, so many people, we're all moving in and out and choosing different lifestyles at different times in our lives, depending on what your children need, how old they are, what's happened to your marriage, all those things. So if you did a snapshot and said at this moment 51% of mothers are working full-time and something like 28% are staying home full-time and 23 or 4 whatever are part-time working outside the home, then that's the picture. But if you took the same picture 3 years from now, it wouldn't be the same people in each piece of the pie. So I think some of those differences are diminishing because we're all moving in and out of different categories, you know. And I'm glad to see that. I'm very glad to see that because what I found out in my research was that mothers have a whole lot more in common than they really have to dividing them. And some of the problems that face mothers and some of the issues that I'm writing about, the lack of valuing their work, absolutely apply whether you're working outside the home or not. And I think if we can focus on those common ground, that common ground, we can really improve the lives of our children and ourselves.
So you see a lot of common ground then, too, perhaps between feminists and women who might be more traditional?
Traditional. Why not? I think women aren't used to thinking strategically or politically or, you know, tactically. But absolutely. I mean, I could see several issues when I did the research that I'm now finding as I talk about the book that people on all sides of the issue can get behind. For instance, the one thing that's really shocking is that when you raise a child, you get zero. You are valued at zero as Social Security credit. You don't earn your own Social Security for that work. The work is a zero. I got my own statement about a year ago saying what I could expect when I retire, and it was 0000. And I said, what are these? And I called the administration, and they said, the Social Security administration, they said, this is for every year you were at home, basically. And I'm thinking, oh, my, you know, this is where we put our lip service, you know, all this lip service on family values. And the work of the family is given a zero. So I don't find that is something very many people think is right. You know, if you're traditional, if you're liberal, whatever you are, feminist, this is not right. So I think it's something we can do something about pretty rapidly if we want to put our minds to it.
What was the biggest revelation for you as a result of writing the book?
What a question. Wow. The biggest revelation. Well, I had thousands of revelations. I was writing it so long, you know, I spent 6 years on it, really. And I said to my husband, swear, you could tell anybody I was never complaining or never bored. I was discovering so much every day. I was going like, Eureka, all the time. I was not sure there'd be a lot of information on this topic because nobody writes about it. Everybody writes about motherhood in different terms and different language. Nobody writes about motherhood as a really huge part of the economy and why we don't value it. So I just loved all the things I found out. You know, I just can't even say which the revelation. But the revelation overall was, I guess, that it really is this huge heart of the economy, and that we still don't recognize it as such, and we still just can't get our mind around the fact that it's really work and that people need to be rewarded for it, or they need to be supported in doing it the way we support people who do other important things for society, such as small farmers or volunteer soldiers. You know, we support a lot of categories of people out there, and mothers certainly rank with all the rest of them, and we don't get any support.
I was surprised about this fact that very little is known, apparently, about what actually happens to money once it goes into a household.
Did that surprise you?
Yeah.
Yeah. But it didn't surprise me so much because what is the most secret thing that nobody ever talks about? I mean, you'll hear more about people's sex life than you'll hear about their money. Don't you think? I think people are very hesitant to give the details.
Yeah.
And, you know, people don't talk, particularly women don't like to talk about it, because most women are dependent in marriage. That was my little chapter, bombshell chapter. You know, one of my people interviewed said that's the dark little secret of family life, you know. It's who really earns the money and who really depends on, you know, the marriage for their support. And how does the money get spent? You know, it's very complex. And it's again, very hard to generalize. Just because one party makes most of the money definitely doesn't mean they're the one who decides how it's spent. But it does mean something. It's not a totally unimportant. It means maybe, you know, there's a little insecurity there. And it means plenty if there's a divorce. It means a horrendous amount, because the person who makes the money can walk away with the income. So it's, you know, that's... Maybe you're right. It's very shocking when you get into it.
Yeah, well, it surprises me, I think, a little bit that, you know, while you're right, at the same time, I think it would be, it would not rise to the top of the bestseller list, everything you wanted to know about family finances and were afraid to ask.
Mm-hmm. You think that would be a fruitful piece of research?
I do, but yeah. I don't know that it would be as... Well, as hot a seller as
the academics would be studying it more than they
yeah.
do. And they don't study it that much. There is a lot of work on bargaining models, and, you know, the sociologists dig into this a little bit, but how how do marriages really work? Is everybody always agreeing, or does one person make all the decisions, or do they bargain over everything? And the answer is yes. You know, there's that pattern in every marriage. You know, marriages are different. But what I focused on here is, you know, who makes most of the money and who makes the biggest financial sacrifice when children come? Who takes the economic risk? Who gets the economic reward of marriage, and who gets the economic risk of marriage? And it's pretty revealing, the answers to that, I think.
A couple of things that spring to mind here, and one is if you are advising a young person about marriage, you might say, well, look for somebody who's going to be an equal partner right down the line.
That's number one.
Right. And
look for someone who's generous in spirit.
Yeah.
That would be really important, I think.
And if you can be equal in what you bring home in a paycheck, that might be something to think about, too.
Yeah. I'd look for somebody big-hearted, generous, and loves kids.
Well, I hope you have them. Ann Crittenden is our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, you're invited to join the conversation. We're talking about The Price of Motherhood. That is the title of Ann Crittenden's latest book, The Price of Motherhood, Why the Most Important Job in the World is Still the Least Valued. My name is Celeste Quinn. The telephone number is 333-WILL. That's the number in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, you can call us toll-free, 800-222-WILL. That's 800-222-WILL. So what about fathers? Are they shouldering more of the responsibilities of parenting these days?
Yeah, they are. And I think this generation of men is doing much more than their fathers did. And it was fun when I was out in California on the book tour. Men would call in and say, right, this is really hard, important work, and I'm home right now with my kids. Maybe there's more of it in California. But, of course, it still is, you know, overwhelmingly the women do child care, and especially younger children, children under five. It's a total female monopoly. So that's why I called it the price of motherhood rather than the price of parenthood. Mm-hmm. But fathers are doing more, and I think partly one reason they are doing more is that women are urging them to. You know, I think we have a value system now that really is putting children for, more important in this picture. I think we are in a period, despite all the headlines about kids gone wrong and all that, I think the historic trend that I discovered is pretty clear, that we're more and more putting more and more time and energy and resources into children. I think that's a fact.
Mm.
Including males,
yeah.
You know, males and females.
I have two friends who are men who will both work in, or one worked in academia, the other is still in the university life. One is well into retirement, and the other, his kids are grown, and he's at the height of his career now. But both got the message as they were young professors mm-hmm. coming up that if you want to succeed, you'll spend less time at home.
Wow, yeah.
And the older man told me it was his greatest regret.
Is that right?
Yeah, and the younger man said what he did was, well, he paid lip service to that suggestion and mm-hmm. and went on with his life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting, because I had heard that too. People saying that, older men sometimes say that, I really regret what I did, you know, that I didn't spend time with my kids. And they can pay a very high price for that sometimes in relationships, but or they just miss the fun. They missed a lot of that experience. And it's still too hard. It's too hard for both parents, you know. It just blows my mind that we keep reading all these articles about 24/7 economy, like it's all good, you know. Shows what hardworking, entrepreneurial people we are, blah, blah. And, you know, of course it's exciting and good, but it's also horrible for families. And we just can't have an economy that eats up all your time like that. What are we going to do, just import, have immigrants? I mean, we're going to have to raise our children, and we're going to have to raise them well, and we want to do it. Women want to do this. And where is the space? So I think we really got to fight for some changes now. Mm. I had a great quote from, you remember that, you know, that financier George Soros in New York? He said, a capitalist economy is a great thing, but we don't want a capitalist society. There's a big difference.
Interesting. Something that struck me as well is that if we discount the work of parents, mothers, and fathers, does it follow that we're coming to parenthood not as well prepared as we should be?
That's a very good question. And not just parenthood, but also the people who professionally deal with children. Children have teachers. Children go to nursery schools. A lot of children go to daycare centers and family care. And what about those people? They're not even required to take one course in child psychology or child development. Parents are not prepared. I asked the guy who runs some of the big daycare operations in Washington, D.C., where I live, and I said, what would be the single most important thing to improve the quality of child care, professional child care? And his answer immediately was parents. Educate parents. So that even parents don't really know, maybe, what children need or what's appropriate at age 18 months. Or I didn't. I mean, I was ignorant as any peasant, you know. I didn't know anything about children. And I had to really get an education. And I think we need to support that more and make it more easy for parents to get the right information, maybe through better pediatrician-type services. And we need to require that people who work with children be educated about them, be trained. It's amazing.
Let's talk with some other listeners. Next, we go to a caller on a car phone on line one. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you this afternoon?
Fine, and you?
Fine. Thank you for the opportunity.
Sure.
I just have several observations. I don't know if I'd call myself a veteran parent, but I have a child that's almost 15, and my youngest one is just turned 4. My wife is a stay-at-home mom who I recently bought a refrigerator magnet that says all mothers are working mothers, and perhaps that could go for fathers, too. Several observations. One is that, I've never heard this discussed before, and I don't know if there's any research, but for the two-parent working families or two parents are working, is there a chance that perhaps one of those parents is taking a job out of the economy that perhaps would help a family where both parents are unemployed? Personal experience, I guess, is that I have been working almost 15 years at my job, and another gentleman started the same time I did, was promoted ahead of me because he is single, has no kids, and was able to devote more time to the job. So I noticed you were, the title of your book is, I believe, The Price of Motherhood.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
That's right.
And perhaps The Price of Parenthood would be an interesting topic,
yeah,
also.
We did mention that. I just said I used the title because it's mostly mothers who are the primary caregivers
right.
of the family, overwhelmingly.
Right.
But you're right. I mean, they are competing, and conscientious fathers are also competing with people who don't have children or don't have these family obligations.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, of course, some people have elderly parents who are family obligations. But the fact is, I had a temporary job once when my child was young in an office that had about 30 people. I was the only one who had a job. And those people, it was their life. You know, they never went home. They
right.
dated each other. They had, you know,
right.
They,
right.
It was just amazing. That was life. Life was work. Work was life.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's just totally destructive to family life.
It seems to be, and I don't really wish to speak against the people who choose that
no,
life.
No, we can't, and that's.
But
the point is, we need more choices. As somebody said, we got more choices in breakfast cereal than we do in viable, decent part-time work.
That's true.
We do not have a very flexible, very rich job market. We're very rigid. We have huge, long hour jobs, and we have a lot of people don't have jobs at all because they can't work those hours.
Right.
And what I'm thinking we need is something what you might call it a rule of proportionality. We absolutely need to fight for this, I think. And that is the right to a job. And I would say it has to be anybody could do this. I wouldn't say just people with children because it would never get off the ground that way. But say anybody should have the right to choose a job that pays equal pay for equal work but has fewer hours.
Mm-hmm.
And fewer benefits, but the same, you know, prorated benefits.
Mm-hmm.
mm-hmm. and slower advancement, but not sidelined and off the track. You see?
Mm-hmm.
So proportional pay, proportional hours, for the hours, proportional pay, proportional benefits, and proportional advancement. Now, that's not asking the world, I don't think.
No,
and that's what it would make such a better world. And it would basically get back to your first question, which is it would maybe create a whole lot more jobs.
Right.
Because everybody wouldn't be gobbling up, you know, a 70-hour job.
Mm-hmm.
There would be more jobs around because they might be 30-hour jobs or 35-hour jobs.
They're and universal health care would help in that respect,
they
too.
Certainly would.
It would even the playing field a little bit.
Yeah,
right.
And take that off the employers. Because
mm-hmm.
they can't afford full health care if it's a person not working full-time, maybe,
mm-hmm.
or working humongous hours. So we do need universal health care, and we need something like proportional work options. And this is not just something I'm dreaming up pie in the sky. It's been done. The Dutch did it very deliberately because back in the early 90s, they had the Dutch disease, it was called. They had high unemployment. They had also, by the way, many of the mothers didn't work. They had one of the highest rates of women out of the workforce who have children.
Mm-hmm.
So they had a lot of people who weren't working for pay. And they decided, let's see what happens if we restructure the job market and allow this kind of shorter working day with prorated benefits and stuff. And they did it. Mm-hmm. And that now about a third of all their jobs are this type of job. They soaked up tons of unemployment. Unemployment plunged. And many women were able to leave home and have a part-time job, which the family needed, they wanted. It was more their choice.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. I just got a bad cold.
I'm sorry. What we'll do here is I'll reintroduce our guest, and I'll thank our caller who's been on the car phone with us this afternoon for calling. And while Ann gets a sip of water, I will reintroduce her. She is Ann Crittenden. She's a journalist. Her latest book is The Price of Motherhood, Why the Most Important Job in the World is Still the Least Valued. It's published by Metropolitan Books, a division of Henry Holt. Ann is a former reporter for the New York Times. She's also worked for Fortune, Newsweek, and CBS News. She's written articles for many publications, including The Nation, Foreign Affairs, and McCall's. We go next to a listener on line two in Urbana. Hello.
Hello. Wonderful program. I just wanted to make a comment about people and how they use their words, especially with at-home moms. I remember my husband and I, about 2 years ago, were looking for an apartment, and the gentleman asked what my husband's occupation was, and he looked at me and he said, "Oh, and you don't work." And I looked up at him, I started laughing, but I read him very, very politely the riot act. "Well, I'm an accountant, I'm, you know, this, that, child care provider, psychologist, cook, cleaner, blah, blah, blah." And after what seemed like a five-minute oration on my part, he said, "Well, I'll never make that mistake again."
just educated somebody.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and then I did it in a nice way, so he didn't feel threatened.
Exactly.
When you go to the store and they notice you don't have your kids with you, they say, "Oh, your husband's babysitting."
Oh, no.
he's watching them just like I would watch them. And the looks that you get, "Well, no, he's babysitting because you're not there." It's a role that's assigned to you that is held in the highest esteem on one hand, but
right.
like you said, when it comes down to it, it just isn't given,
no.
I think, the respect that it's due.
This is just a monster gap in our stated values, in our practices, and it's a huge gap. I'm really driving a truck right into this gap and saying, we got to close this thing. You know, it's just crazy. We say we believe in families and children and value, blah, blah. And then what do? We just disregard it in the worst way. So
I
think when we change consciousness about it, we can make a lot of improvement.
Definitely.
I mean, we worry about families, say, "Well, why are things going wrong?" Without looking at this. This is one of the major reasons. We make it hard for people to spend time with children.
Well, I am definitely going out and getting your book, and I really appreciate you doing your bit to bring this to the national forefront, because I think it's a very important issue. Thank you.
Peter, it's the people who work with young children. I went to a conference of early child care workers, and they had a big sign, I am not a babysitter. I never sat on a baby. They're educators.
We haven't talked a whole lot about employers. Offer us some examples here as a way to wrap up of what employers are doing right, what they're doing wrong, and what they could be doing better for families.
Oh, boy, I think that's frankly the hardest bit. If I can get myself together. I was out in the rain over the weekend, and I got a cold. Anyway, what they're doing is, of course, there is more flexible offerings now, and I think particularly there's much more working from home, and it's getting more respectable, and people are slow to getting used to it. But it's glacial. I mean, the change is glacial. I've read studies that said 3 or 4% of employees take advantage of these policies that allow part-time or shorter work week or flex time and all those different things. Because basically we still have a culture that says if you're not fully devoted, you know, nothing more important than that job, you're not going to get ahead. And so people don't take the policies. They'll be stigmatized. Or I also discovered when I did the reporting that companies don't really enforce them. They let managers down the line decide whether an employee gets the right to that or not. They don't come down from on high and say, everybody who asks for it will get it. They won't do that. So the managers can say, no, can't spare you. No, we've had a downsizing and you're going to have to work 50 hours a week now instead of 40. I had cases of women who married and single, who had jobs that were hired 9 to 5, and suddenly told, you're going to have to work 50 hours a week or whatever. And one woman said, I can't even see my child if I work these hours. She was fired. And these couple of cases I wrote about went to the state Supreme Court, and they were thrown out. The women did not win. They were told, well, we don't have any public policy that enforces a parent's right to be a parent, allows a parent to fulfill their obligations as a parent. Well, I'm saying we need that policy. You know, we need to tell companies, I'm sorry, but people can't be worked like that. They have to have an option.
It seems to me, too, that whether workers have children or not, it's like our turn is coming. I mean, many folks now are taking care of other members of the family.
Right. Look at the demography. Demographics. People are getting older and older, and more people will be caring for them. Who are those people going to be? I mean, somebody's going to do it. And we're not ready. We're not setting up a system that will allow that with shorter work weeks, you know. Because who's going to care for the caregivers? How are they going to make a living? We've got this thing on a track here that isn't sustainable. And it always gets me that we talk about independent, let me all be independent, but we're really only independent about 60% of our lives. I mean, the first 20 years you're dependent on your parents, and roughly the last 10 you're dependent on Social Security system, other people's children paying into it, or your own children caring for you, or some kind of, you know, other people caring. So we have, as I said in my book, we have a welfare state, but we don't have a caring state that makes space for caring. And that's what this is really about.
Anne?
I better take care of myself.
Yeah.
I really didn't think
so. You don't need to apologize. I'm sorry that we sort of asked you to talk with us for such a long period of time here this afternoon.
I get too excited not talking to you.
No, that's not it at all. I hope you go and have a cup of hot tea and a lozenge or something.
In this minute.
Take care of yourself.
Thank you.
Anne Crittenden has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. We wish her good health. And if you're interested in learning more about this topic, look for her book, The Price of Motherhood, Why the Most Important Job in the World is Still the Least Valued.